If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it is that wonderful time of week where you cuddle up next to the fire and you turn up the volume on your podcast playing device to listen to Game Dev Unchained, the number one podcast for video game development and the lifestyle thereof. And I came this week with the person who has the best recipe for the corner of the street lemonade, Mr. Brandon.
What's up, everybody? Thank you, Larry, for tasting my lemonade. Please welcome our special guest this week, Joshua Boggs.
Hey, Josh.
Thanks for having me. Thank you. Nice to be here. I want some of the lemonade.
I'll give you some after.
I told you, it's the best recipe, man.
So, Josh, thank you so much. I found Josh by reading one of your articles, Grappling to the Dark Sides of the Industry. And, of course, we'll link it in the description. But better yet, before we get into that, do you mind going over your resume, kind of give us a little background of where you come from?
Yeah, sure. So I worked at EA for a number of years in Australia, and then maybe probably about about 4.5 years ago, I left there with some friends from EA, and we started our own studio called Love Shack. And since then, we've made the game Framed, which is like a comic puzzle game where you rearrange panels and it changes what happens in the story and everything. So that's my main resume. It's like half AAA, half indie, I guess.
I think that's the best kind of resume, though. That shows that you've done top and bottom.
You've been on both sides of the fence, so you can just sit on it for the rest of your life. You don't need to like take sides anymore.
Yes, for sure.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Brandon.
The first thing that caught my eye is that Framed, right, critically acclaimed, wildly successful, caught the eye of Hideo Kojima, right?
Yeah.
He named it as one of his best games in 2014, and Hideo Kojima is my best director, so that's like by association. Indirectly admire your work.
But wow.
Frame as well is like one of the best looking games I remember when it was coming out and being announced. So was it a concept that you had before you rage quit, or was something in development after?
Legally, it was something I had after.
Got it.
it came from the idea of like, you know, like a lot of games, you know, whether it's a third person game or just most games in general, you're sort of moving through an environment and you have like a set number of actions. And you know, they sort of form the basis of your mechanics. Mm-hmm. And I kind of wanted to flip that on its head instead and have like this finite environment and these actions that could always change. So that's kind of where like the base idea came from, and then it didn't really go anywhere for a while. And then I was reading Scott McCloud's Understanding Comics.
Oh, that's a really good book.
So good. It's not even about comics. Well, it is, but like
storytelling,
it's so applicable to everything else. Yeah. I got like 3 pages in, and then like, you know, when you just have that like brainwave of an idea. Mm-hmm. That was pretty much Framed right then and there.
Nice. Is Scott McCloud in the credits of your game?
Should be. Now that I think about it, I think I need to add him in there. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
So the development of this idea, did you come out with it on your own and then you started recruiting, or was it more like those lunch breaks?
Those blocks. You mean lunch breaks at his house?
Yes. At your house. Yeah.
So it was, like most ideas, like it started off, you know, with a kind of core part, and then it was with collaborating with the rest of the team. So, the artist Ollie Brown and Adrian Moore, who does a lot of the music, and Stuart Lloyd, who does all the animation in the game. It was just kind of like a natural exploration process of the idea and like what and like a lot of playtesting as well. Because like the first version of the game is like really slow and really dark, like dark in tone colors, and like, you know, there's like murder, and it's just unplayable because it's just like no words as well, and it's just a mess. And then once we started like stripping all that out, you know, we got down to the core of what the game was telling us it wanted to be.
So after your first attempt, right, where you have that initial aha moment from reading the Scott McCloud book to getting your first playable version done, how close do you say you guys were to the goal versus like, oh shit, like, okay, this whole half needs to get cut and we need to redo all of this?
well, luckily, I mean, in terms of, so in terms of like the amount of work we put into it, it wasn't that much because we, for the first build, we were only trying to do like 5 or 6 levels, or 5 or 6 scenes. So we pretty quickly worked out what didn't work. But tonally and thematically, like, we were way off base initially, and it just sort of you know, was a process of exploring it and like listening to the game and like working out what the game is trying to tell us by playing it and figuring out what's wrong with it.
I love that little that phrase you just dropped on us, listening to the game. That's that's some Sixth Sense shit right there for game designers. Environment artists, engineers, you guys don't have that. Only designers have that.
Yes.
I'm just kidding.
The game is shitty. That's what the artists are saying. Yeah, this is pretty much crap.
but it's the same. It's the same with a lot of art, right? Like, I mean, filmmakers as well, and you know, musicians, artists as well. Like, you know, when you're experiencing what it is, and something doesn't feel right, it's the art itself speaking to you, you know, saying something's not right, and you have to work out what it is and why. And yeah, it's a bit like playing doctor, I guess.
Yeah, that's a great analogy though. I like that.
So this prototyping phase, how long was that exactly before you got your
I think it was about somewhere between 3 to 6 months. So about 3 months of it was exploration, and then the last 3 was we were pretty sure it was right. And then once we showed it to other people, I think it was during PAX Australia. It was the first PAX in Australia, and that, like, the amount of people that really loved it, and like, you know, Jerry Hawkins from PAX, like, was raving about it during everything, and we got right up some on Penny Arcade, and like that was when we realized, like, yeah, this is like the direction it needs to go, and like this is why everyone likes it. Like, it's hitting the right notes.
Did you have initial funding, or was it more like you guys gathering what you guys have and give it a shot for 6 months for PAC?
Yeah. So at the very beginning, we applied for funding, and we got like a little bit, like not as much as we asked for, but that helped us sort of, you know, get enough of it going so that, you know, we could apply a few more times and get a lot of other little small grants. We were really lucky because at that time, you know, cause like the whole GFC, in 2009, right. All the big studios in Australia, well, not all, but like 90% of them all shut down, because like no work was coming in from the States and everywhere else. So that left a lot of people starting their own companies, and then like the government jumped in and was like, here's, you know, like grants for starting things. And you know, they're still really competitive, but it certainly helped a lot of people get up off the ground.
Can you describe what it was like? And this is a question I actually want to know because I might have some personal vested interest in this, but developing your ideas before any funding versus developing your ideas after that first initial bit of funding came through. Can you describe which experience was like, Oh yes, you know, like I'm hoping that getting a little bit of seed money is like, pew, it gives you validation, it gives you support, it gives you comfort because you have some way to pay bills.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
It's just as you describe. It does pay your bills. It certainly makes everything seem a lot more real. Mm-hmm. And I think a part of that is it makes you suddenly very accountable. Mm-hmm. And I think like it's the same like whether you're working in a big studio or a small studio. Like I think making someone accountable for their work is the best thing you can do for them. Like it will make their work much better. So I think that was like really good for us because it suddenly made us all really accountable. Because if we don't deliver, like there's all this money that we've wasted and, you know, the anxiety that goes with that.
Does that accountability also bring any sort of added pressure, or are you like as a professional, like, you know what? Yes, I do acknowledge that this is not my money, but I'm faithful to this product. I can listen to the game. I'm not worried. Where do you think you lie on that?
I think I had a lot of faith in the project by that point, like by the time money finally arrived.
Gotcha.
Versus like when it was confirmed that we would get it. Because I think there's about 3 months in between then as well. Like, I think pressure can be good a lot of the time too. So it was the right kind of pressure, like, because, you know, as you said, it was combined with like validation and people being like excited for, you know, this new thing you're doing. Mm-hmm. So it was the right kind of pressure, in, you know, very different to like crunch time pressure, which is, you know, as from what you both have said, what you've been through. I'm sure you can relate. That's very difficult pressure.
And now one last one for me before, you know, we kind of open the floor up a little bit more conversationally. I want to ask about, you did describe, you said in our game, we had a very finite environment with a lot of choices and a lot of options. Does an approach like that make it harder for you to call your game done? Right. Because I would imagine you're always like, oh, and then we can do this. We can do this. You know, where did you feel like you draw the line and how easy was it to do so?
It was quite hard. I think from a lack of experience for us in running a studio, like a business, for Framed, like, I mean, it did well, you know, critically and commercially. But like, you know, we had run out of money by the time we were done. And we were just like trying to piece like these bits that weren't quite fitting together as best as we could in like this very tight deadline.
Yes.
It was a bit of a mess and we're making sure we're not doing it that way this time, but
going for the prototyping phase when you said 4 to 6 months you got your funding, did you guys have how far off the mark was your original estimate for the project? The actual project being delivered.
So I'm going to take like 2 months.
I vaguely remember us estimating. For some reason, there's a dollar value that I remember because I think I had to write it down so many times for initial funding applications. And we were like, $190,000. Dollars sounds, you know, for like a 4 to 8 team, you know, team of 4 to 8 over a year or so, that should work out. But you know, that obviously wasn't enough. And we did require more funding. I think initially we were like, the game will take 12 months to make or something. And it was like double that, at least, I think 2.5. Yeah.
That's like the first thing I hear from most indie groups. It's like, 1 year, we can do this in 1 year.
Yeah, do it in 1 year. I mean, if you did everything perfectly, in theory, you could. But yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's
exploring. Like,
that's exactly what it is. It's like, yeah, exactly this prototype, this idea that is written in this game design document will take 1 year. But within that time frame, things can go wrong, things can change, people may come, people may go. Yep. You know, there's so many intangibles that you have to build into your buffer, so to speak.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So yeah, it was about 2.5 times longer than we originally estimated.
And if you can elaborate, or if you don't want to, that's fine. Was there one big thing that kind of showed up in the development process where you're like, oh shit, we may not be able to recover from this? Was there a big intangible you had to deal with?
Yeah. I mean, I think story-wise, we had a few different versions going at once. Mm-hmm. Because I remember, for me personally, like I had an idea for a cool twist, but also like a few other versions of what could happen. And I was more interested in like how you could tell a story versus like what it was. So it was kind of like this like morbid curiosity into like how could you tell a story without words and, mm-hmm. you know, movable panels and everything. And it turns out that that's really, really, really hard, especially when you're wanting to keep the game fun and engaging. So, you know, we tried a few versions. None of them were, we were really feeling, and then we got help on board. And then, you know, that too didn't work out too well either. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just like a case of the project itself. Like it takes a long time to get used to the idea of what it is and how to communicate certain things. So yeah, for us, like the narrative at the end was like scraping together like heaps of pieces and just trying to like fix as much of it as we could.
Nice. So what I want to know now is, let's talk about something good instead of problems. let's let people know that there's a silver lining. What was probably the best thing about this project in your opinion? Like the one thing or the one kernel from the experience where you're like, yeah, man, this is it for me. I'm so happy. This is why it exists.
Oh, so during production?
Like, or just like there's the, a point the whole outcome at like, because you made this, X happened, and that X is so important or so valuable to you, it was life changing.
Yeah, I think for that would definitely be, you know, not including like kind of your aha moments of production. Mm-hmm. Would be like, you know, Kojima. That was pretty much,
yeah,
like made like it made kind of all the suffering worth it almost, particularly because like I wanted, after playing his games as like an adolescent, like mm. that was the point where I was like, I want to make games when I get older. Mm. And then to kind of have that like full circleness of your career sort of thing, like mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly made me less like, during development, I was really seeking for some sort of approval with like awards and everything all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And that certainly distinguished or helped distinguish that. Yeah. But yeah, like, I mean, that I think how obsessed I was over that validation during development certainly hampered, you know, like mental health and expectations for the game and like making it longer than it needs to be and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, that's really serious stuff, man, because let's be real and let's be adults here. There's a lot of people in the game industry who are working very, very hard, who aren't getting credit, pats on the back, or getting acknowledgement, or even just appreciation, like simple appreciation mm. for their efforts. They're getting taken advantage of, they're getting mistreated, you know. That's kind of why we're starting this podcast, because we want to shine light on situations that people don't want to talk about or are afraid to take a stand on. And yeah. I think mental health in the game industry is a very important issue. You know, I myself have personal experiences where I like wake up and it's like, man, I don't even want to be here. And yeah. he's being like, you know, like not even like work, but just
at yeah. AS, yeah. Larry, wake up.
it's tough out here, man. It really is. It's a fun place to be when it's fun, but it's work just like any other job, and it's very taxing at times because a lot of us have a personal connection to what we're doing. You know, like, it's not like I'm doing your taxes, you just show up and I could care less. I'm doing your numbers. Hey, you saved $2,000 this year. See you next year. Yeah. Right? Like, there's an attachment to something that you put your blood, sweat, and tears into creating. And I mean, it's hard to say that people, you know, aren't going to get burnt out or overwork themselves because they really believe in what they're trying to do. And it means something to them when somebody says something good or bad about their project, you know?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I think ultimately, right, that's because all forms of art, right, are just some form of ultimately like communication. Like a lot of people would say expression, but expression as well is just like a form of trying to communicate something to other people. Like without other people, it doesn't mean anything, right? So, yeah, you know, if ultimately doesn't everything people make require, you know, the validation or, you know, not necessarily validation, but like ingestion of that from other people. And yeah, when you don't get it at all, like, it's really bad. And if you get too much of one, it skews your expectations and reality. Yeah.
Yeah. I will say I did see your GDC talk, about, you know, grappling with depression in the game industry, and man, it's a ride is what I'll say. You know, cause like the whole time I'm like, yeah, he's going to talk about how awesome this game was, but you see the title, so you're like expecting the rug to be pulled out from under you. And that happens like within 30 seconds. And so you're going through this, like, you're really being brought down to earth as far as like, quote unquote, living the dream or what it really takes to produce a passion project, especially when you're dealing with something, you know? But I want to fast forward to a specific moment in the talk that I really admired. You said you're at EA and a guy that was, I guess, quitting had like walked past you as he was leaving. And you're like, hey, you know, why are you quitting the dream? Or wow, this you're living the dream. Why leave?
Yeah.
I forget how you said it. And his response was actually very poignant to me, even as a viewer from your secondhand experience of your firsthand recount.
Yeah.
Was him saying, I want to go and build a life that's fulfilling because this isn't a dream. If it's a dream, your dream is too narrow. Or if you're living the dream, your dream is too narrow. And if it is a dream, that means it's so big and so vast that it's going to be an impossibility. So he said, I would rather spend my time building a life that's fruitful and meaningful. Or correct me if I'm wrong, but that's kind of what I took from it. And that was profound.
Yeah. It was very much, I'm trying to remember the exact words, but it was essentially, that living the dream, while that can be nice, it is just a dream. Mm-hmm. Like at some point we need to wake up, right? And, you know, dreams kind of exist to enrich our lives, but if it's not doing that, then, you know, it's time to wake up.
Yeah.
That sort of thing. But yes, I think I elaborate a lot more, and I think I said it the way that you said, yeah. But yeah, it's I think everyone has stories like that of people who've been in the industry for ages, you know, like particularly at like AAA studios, and you know, they're asking like these veterans that leave, and you're like, why are you leaving? Like, isn't this like the best thing? And they're like, like, it's, you know, I guess that's just part of getting older, maybe. Like,
yeah.
your priorities change.
I think developers in the game industry age in dog years. The amount of crunch that we put in. I mean, other industries have deal with these type of issues too. Not to say like
the
game industry is special or anything, but I think it's heavier because we're such in a creative space where we're making games, so games should be fun to make. Like, you should be lucky that you're not pushing numbers around or just, you know, doing other mundane things. But, you know, I think the expectations that we set up for ourselves is probably why we fall so much faster, deeper. And I think a lot of the times it's so much easier for developers to kind of be crawling in the corner and do a good job, but no one has checked up on you or asked about you. Like, it's so easy to get isolated in here. And literally live on the internet as an indie developer.
Yeah, pretty much, yeah.
And no one would even come into your home and check up on you. So it's very easy to be in that mental state. I, like, personally, I went through a period once where I would pretty much not talk to anyone for a while, like mostly internal thoughts. And I can understand how Tom Hanks would be speaking out to Wilson, right? Because if you don't talk to anyone, you really will get kind of crazy.
Yeah.
Dude, we see that on the streets of LA every day.
Yeah, it's I wonder, like, if it's something to do with the fact that it is a creative pursuit, and also the fact that like games especially, I mean, film too, and a lot of other things, but like the turnaround time between putting what's in your mind, like that inspiration, into something tangible is so long. Like, it's longer than taking out a camera and filming something. Like, it's longer than just sketching something. It's longer than just, like, you know, trying a new riff on you know, guitar or piano chords or whatever. Like, it is so long that it requires, like, significantly more technical labor, I guess. Mm-hmm. Which means, like, I guess maybe that kind of, like, overworks us, because like all creative endeavors invest, like, you're putting yourself into it, right? So you're invested in it. But yeah, I have been thinking about, like, what is it about games that seems to find, you know, seems to have so many people that have similar experiences. But then again, maybe that's just like a bias, because we're all technically able and on the internet and everything. Yeah,
I mean, one thing's for sure, the burnout rate in the game industry is faster than other industries. Like, I don't know any of my other friends who don't work in video games that talks about, like, 10 years and I'm out, even if it's a stable job. It's like, what are you talking about? Where are you going? What are you going to do?
Yeah. 10 years, you're like just now getting to the point where you're getting paid well, right?
So, yeah.
To think about leaving at that point seems ludicrous.
Yeah, that's true.
So I got a question. And I always phrase, like, the tough, like, I'm going to open up personally questions with, like, you don't have to answer this, but I'm hoping you will.
Yeah.
Knowing everything that you went through, that your team went through, like, the entire experience from day one to day done for your game Framed, knowing what it was going to cost you, what it was going to tax you, what you were going to go through emotionally and have to deal with, the ups, the downs. If you could do it all over again, like, if you had to, right? If you're going to make Frame 2 and you knew it was going to be exactly the same, but you would get to the same point at the end, would you do it again?
I guess, like, if I could go back in time and like future me is like old and rugged and like, it's like, what about like the warning? That's difficult, because like, the best I can describe Framed is like, it was the best of times and the worst of times. And now, like, I'm doing really, really well, like a lot better than I ever have been. And I think going through all of that, you know, and being fortunate enough to have like the support to come out the other side, has definitely like been some hard lessons learned that, you know, I won't forget. But I think, like short term wise, like I'd probably be like, it wasn't worth it. Mm-hmm. But then like really, everything it costs and taxes you, I would probably feel the same. Like if I just stayed at EA and been unhappy, like if the choice was to remain somewhere and be unhappy or go out on my own, lose a lot, learn a lot, I you know, in that sense, I probably would do it again, but give myself a bit of advice beforehand. Yeah.
If you can think of one key piece of advice you would give to yourself on day one, what do you think it would be?
I think it would be, no matter what you do, and I mean, I think this is true of most things in life, no matter what you decide, no matter what you do, there's always a cost. And that cost can be time, it can be like money, or it can be like relationships. You know, like there's always a cost for what you do. And it's just a matter of choosing what you want to lose. So like whether it's time or money, or like whether, you know, I think thinking about it that way of like deciding what to lose makes you put things into perspective and forces you to kind of take a healthy marathon like approach instead of like jumping into the abyss without a parachute, hoping everything will work out before you hit the bottom, sort of thing.
Yeah. Jesus. And what about you as the entrepreneur? Do you have a key piece of entrepreneurial advice that you would bestow upon day one self?
That's tricky. You mean like something I've learned that I couldn't have known?
From the business end. So maybe not development itself, but like, you know, write the grant. Who knows if you'll get the money or not? It's worth it. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, right. Yeah. I mean, that is very much what we did, or what I did. It was just like apply for every sort of grant that we could. I think in that case, it is very much like apply for everything. Take like seize every opportunity, obviously. And like our initial pitch, to put this in perspective, in front of like government, you know, funding publishers that see like scripts and stuff for movies and everything, I went to the office and all I had was, like for the initial pitch, it was just framed, cut, like drawn on a piece of paper. Like the panels, and they were cut out, and there was Stickman drawn on them.
Oh, man.
It was made a simple level, and I was like, "All right, so this is the game." So, like I had the kind of like lofty pitch, and then like the hands-on. This is how it works.
Yeah.
And made them like move the panels around and like describe what happens in it. It thankfully worked out.
But you gave them an interactive experience, even in your pitch.
Yeah, I guess it was, even though it was pen and paper and incredibly low budget.
It was cut out on the desk, moving the frame around.
But that's but it's pretty cool though, because it involved them, you know.
Yeah, you have to. Yeah,
I think to put that more tangibly, it's like know your limitations. It's like know what you're good at, and like know your limitations and use your limitations to your advantage. Because yeah, like being. Like I think I was like 25-ish at the time, so like still young, obviously, like being a young guy with just this idea and knowing that like can be infectious and like trying to bring people in can work. But yeah,
man, I like that. I'm gonna take that little bit of advice. Like, these are my stick figures, and then you
so yeah, give me your money. Like, if he did it with like pen and paper.
Yeah. It's kind of, I'm not going to lie.
Anyone can do it. Yeah.
There's probably some people here who have pitched for financing who are like spent nights and weeks like preparing all this stuff and didn't get the funding. And here you go with your stick figure drawings and like some scotch tape and you came out with money.
That's awesome. A lot of it is good timing. A lot of it's, you know, the quality of the pitch. I mean, you had a lot of things lined up that helped, and I mean, your passion probably came through too.
Yeah, I think you're definitely right there.
What I want to know is, how do a bunch of people with financing that they know needs to be tracked, and it's government financing, so there's going to be a paper trail. And this is, I don't mean this disrespectfully, I'm just trying to build this in my mind.
Yeah, right?
Like, a guy walks in with like a stick figure presentation and says, I'm going to be making a video game, like a fully electronic video game. And this is the best I can do to like show how that's going to work. You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of room for their imagination.
I think I pitched it as, so we're still working on the prototype I can't remember how exactly I said it, but I think it was something along the lines of like, like, I want you to be able to imagine the feeling. So I've brought this along as opposed to like, gotcha. You know, like trying to play into it. But then again, like, I don't know, maybe it worked because they see that every day. Mm-hmm. Not what I did, but you know, they see interactive experiences every day, and maybe it made it more memorable or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And actually I will credit you this, right? Like, if we're talking about people who don't play video games a lot, imagine if you did walk in with a playable demo and you're like, okay, so you got a WASD to move around, and they're like, WASD, what?
Yeah.
I mean? And so you're already off on the wrong foot. So you might've had like the perfect approach. That's
yeah. Like accidentally perfect.
Yeah, the more you know, man. This is awesome. This is good stuff.
Go ahead.
Well, obviously, Frame did well commercially and critically, like you said before. And during development, you entered a lot of, pack arcades, all these little demo shows, and was earning a lot of more rewards, more critical acclaim, more coverage, basically. And you know, as an indie developer, I would imagine something like that would be exciting, would be validating, would be nice. But yeah, it wasn't until I read your article that I realized, yeah, it could totally be a, you know, two-edged sword.
Yeah, double-edged sword.
Double-edged sword. Can you kind of go into that a bit more, like, as in how exactly it started to make you think of a different way and kind of move you away from just making the game for yourself?
Yeah, I think so a lot of it was expectation, not just from others, but also from myself from that point onwards. So I think like the first couple of awards were like really exciting and really validating, and like we were all really proud of what we were doing. And like I was submitting these awards because there were two reasons. One was because it feels good and I wanted it.
Yeah.
And the other was because like it's good marketing for your game as well, right?
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So like I'd always use that as like rationale as well. After the first few, it started, like I noticed as well, like even attending a couple events, a couple times some people were like, oh, Frame's here, it's gonna win, sort of thing.
Oh, man.
And so like there was very much like an expectation that like you had to be either nominated or win. So like you're submitting to everything because like you need it to get your game known and everything. But if you win, you don't feel good. Like you just are like, okay, like that was expected. Mm-hmm. And if you don't, you feel like really bad.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a bit like being it's entirely the same. It's like addiction, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like, I think personally, I'd become addicted to this validation, this external validation, as opposed to having like that confidence and faith and your gut that a creator has. So I'd lost sight of that, of like my value, so to speak, and like I had become obsessed with like these goals that I had set. I very much became addicted and obsessed with it, and I think like it had a very negative effect on, you know, my mental health and the way I would then make decisions, because it was like, whether I was aware of it or not, it was like driving a lot of rationale behind decisions. And then from there, like you start unraveling other parts of your life, and also like from a creative perspective, like the reason you're doing it starts changing maybe, which changes like the kind of heart and soul of the project a bit. Like it, that didn't really have happened, but like, you know, like if you were to extrapolate that out, you'd end up with, you know, it's the same thing as why like a lot of sophomore albums, for example, aren't super good, because the first one they were just making what they wanted,
mm-hmm.
and it did well. And the second one, there were all these expectations and they knew what the people liked, what they liked. So they delivered what they liked, not what they had to say or felt passionate about. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I think creatively it also kind of hit there as well. And knowing that and trying to reconcile that and like wrestling with that kind of in every aspect of your life, from like creative work to like business work, and like making sure you got enough money to deliver what everyone's expecting, and then like investing so much in that that like all the other parts of your life sort of fall by the wayside and get neglected. And I think that's kind of the thing of like knowing like everything costs something. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's like ways we could have done that way healthier, but you know, I don't think we had the experience or the mentorship to like be aware of that at the time.
Do you feel like there were people on your team who were also taking on as much or similar amounts of the emotional burden going through the development?
I think at the time I definitely felt like it was just me. Like I do know, like since the talk I gave, like I know the other people on the team were like, shit, didn't realize how much you were doing and how much you were struggling, and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think that as well, like ultimately is also like my fault and my responsibility. Like it's that wanting to be the front man thing as well, right? Like wanting that attention, wanting that acclaim, and like taking on so much, mm-hmm. like trying to own too much and not just like letting go, and sharing the burden. I think that also weighs into it too. So like, I don't, like blame any of my team at all. They've always been there and supportive. So I think it's entirely my fault for, kind of becoming addicted and corrupted by these ideas and then just, you know, like not sharing the load.
Yeah.
I'm going to blame it on Kojima. It started with him.
Well, it was interesting because the good thing about Kojima actually was it kind of like knocked me out of it a bit, because it reminded me like why, like above everything else, it reminded me why I wanted to make games. Like it reminded me to being a kid again and like what it was. So that was what actually like I was sort of coming out of it because we'd finished the project, mm-hmm. but that was what really made me kind of feel like maybe it was worth it. But like that sounds bad because like it shouldn't have been worth it really. And like got incredibly lucky to have that sort of validation, and it is still validation as well, which is the same thing I'm like criticizing and saying kind of ruined everything. But I think the point I'm trying to make is like it technically, and I think on surface level it is validation, but more importantly it was a reminder of like my values and like that passion that is in there. And yeah, I think like, you know, that's why this time around, you know, we've been doing frame two for a while, just kind of quietly plodding along, and I'm not particularly pushing us to go down that route at all. Mm-hmm. Just taking a much more healthy, measured approach to it.
Yeah, let some of those other games win awards.
Well, I mean, what's important is that, like, even though you went the hard route, right? There's no doubt in my mind that you could achieve the same results. Going about a healthier way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and I think that was because I was so obsessed with it. Like, I couldn't see that, right? Like, my thought processes are not healthy anymore, and they're not thinking of the big picture. So, yeah, that it's like once you start falling in, like, I think either having the knowledge that it can happen or having someone there to kind of pull you out is really important. And like on big teams like AAA, right, like you're constantly around people, mm-hmm. and so you're kind of able, I think, to kind of pull out a little more. But with like independent developers that are like small scale and you know, it's a lot easier to kind of just run with your own goals and decisions and not let anyone stop you.
Yeah. Plus it's scary going out there. Like, you feel like every decision can make or break your ship.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
heavier. Every risk.
Yeah.
So I'm going to ask, with dealing with depression or dealing with so much pressure and tension to achieve, you know, did you ever notice yourself building up any resentment towards people even on your team who at a moment in time may not have had or pushed like you were pushing or worked like you were working? You know, was that ever a thing?
Yeah, definitely was. I think I might have even touched on it really briefly in the talk. I definitely did feel that way. But I think as well, like, I just want to make it clear that I think was due to bad thought processes and wasn't at all their fault, was entirely my own doing that I felt that way. There was like a lot of feeling of resentment of like being like, I'm doing all the stuff, why isn't anyone else? Sort of thing, and they wouldn't understand, and you know, they kind of like us versus them mentality within your own team. Yeah. But I'm more of a, I'm not like super confrontational, so I just kind of like harbor on it until like something like snaps, which is also really bad as well when you think about it, because
it builds up.
Yeah, exactly. We all work well as a team, and yeah, we've chatted about stuff like that now.
Joshua's showing up in meetings with like gar eyes, black bags around.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, where you guys been? I've been staying up all night.
Oh yeah, it must be nice to go home.
I think I said that to someone once at EA.
Oh man.
I think it was during crunch and something. Someone went home and like, you know how it's that unspoken thing of like, what do you want for dinner? And it's like, oh god, I'm gonna be here all night. And then I think one of the other team members went home, like snuck out, went home and came back. It was like it was like full of energy and stuff. And I was at one point, I was just like, yeah, it must be really nice to go home and to your own bed and sleep or something. like totally inappropriate. But it was just like so burnt out.
It's like, damn, Gara, chill, bro.
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's a sad, true, funny story, right? Like, we have to acknowledge all the parts of it. It's sad, it's true, and it's funny.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things that you hit a certain age or a certain time in your career where you're like, the producer comes at you with that question. It's like, what do you want for dinner? And you look at him, it's like, Neo moment, no. No, I'm not doing this. And they really can't do anything about it, right? There's no...
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It's like, I'm going home. It's 8 p.m., bro. I'm going home.
Yeah. I think, 8 p.m. I think... I get the feeling like a lot of it, like they immediately, I have a theory that like the way they go about it is they immediately get like the juniors on first.
Yeah.
And then they build up the snowball of the number of people that are staying and then come to the ones that have the confidence to be like, no, I'm not staying. Be like, well, everyone else is staying.
Yeah,
so you're like, oh, God.
So you're good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just made a decision at this point in my career. Is like, no, if I have to stay, that's your fault, right? Like,
yeah,
you didn't plan it correctly.
Yeah, you decided we had to ship before Christmas, not me.
That's your fault. Good luck. I hope you've been taking like art classes at night, Mr. Producer.
Yeah.
Well, I got a light story to kind of pat the backs of the producers who listen to this podcast, because I'm sure there's one or two.
Larry always comes in.
I'm sure we scared most of them away, and there's like one or two producers that actually can take the punishment. Right. So I used to order food for the team because I started in production. And man, there was no worse thing you could do as a producer than not order enough food for the team of people who was staying late.
Oh, man.
My goodness, let me tell you, I like the looks and they would like passive aggressively try to ration out, like, wow, I guess we're gonna have to share all these pieces of fit, like, you know what I mean, like, no, you can hear. So anybody who has shorted an order somehow, some way, if I didn't do the math, or you didn't say you were staying and you fucking showed up anyway.
Yeah, that's,
you know, I'm sorry.
I'll just leave. Savages.
that one always, I forgot about that. I forgot that people are like, no, I'm not staying. And then totally they do stay. But yeah. But the thing is, they stay and they take the food and they go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
Yep.
It's a double F you to the people who are staying deserving.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just doesn't work. People staying are like,
no, I know.
They eat for an hour or two, right? And they web browse till 9. And then maybe they work another 40 minutes.
Yeah.
It's like,
I know. And you're like, it costs the company so much as well.
It's just out of hate. No one's going to like willingly want to work after being told as adults to stay and fix their problem.
Yeah.
It's hard being a grown adult and having another grown, like an adult, just like tell you what to do on the spot. Like, pick this shit up. Yeah. Like, no. It doesn't work. Excuse my language. I've been cussing a lot. I have some repressed memories.
Well, like turning it back around, it's like the opposite's true, right? When this is your project from the get-go, your team, your small team, you want to put like every minute unhealthily. You want to like drain yourself to the point where you can't continue on, because that, you know, everything's riding on it. You want to make sure at the very least not to fail. Like, this is kind of like a, you know, you've been wanting this your whole career. You're finally getting the opportunity. You're doing it, right? And you're at the halfway point. You're getting all these awards, you're getting these all of these critical acclaim, you're getting people rooting for you, right? It becomes more than just yourself. You're like, have this whole support that you don't want to let down. It's so much pressure when you're just a small team. Like, I can't even imagine. So when I read your article, like, in a very small way, I can totally relate because I'm not there yet at all. But, you know, at the very beginning of the podcast, you were mentioning, like, living the dream, right? And I really think when you're an indie developer, all you're doing is just dreaming of getting there. And
that's a good,
a lot
that's
of the things to. Life your wife girlfriend boyfriend whatever kind of get pushed back because there's a weird balance, or you have to be selfish in some way to achieve this. Giving it all you got, at the same time everything else is kind of on pause. Like, when did you realize that moment? Was it during development when you realized that, or after in retrospect, where you're like, all right, I need to make some adjustments?
I think I started feeling quite down about everything sort of around six to nine months before release. But I didn't have the insight to work out what it was. And then towards the end, like, I was just so focused, like, so intensely focused on, like, making it as good as it could be. You know, you're just, like, crunching all the time. And it's, like, self-imposed crunch, you know, because, like you say, you're trying to make it the best thing it can possibly be within the finite time that you have. I think in retrospect, like, it was, you know, remembering, I'm trying to think what exactly it was. It was just remembering that, just like little lessons I'd learned earlier in my career, like once I'd had time to decompress, you know, like the thing that my friend leaving EA had said, and, you know, I think Kojima thing happened as well. And it reminded me of like why I wanted to make stuff, And then just also like getting in contact with people that I, you know, shunned for so long, and all of that, like the kind of going back to why, like, you know, answering the why, like, why am I doing this? You know, why did I sacrifice so much? And I think like intensely looking inward to that answer kind of made me re-remember that, like, this isn't something to kill yourself over. Like, it's not, it's as great as it is, it's not worth that much. And I think personally I do things a lot because, like, I want to leave something behind when I'm gone, you know, when I'm dead and gone. Like, I want some sort of, and I think we all want that, you know, some sort of legacy, some sort of like mark that we were here. But also just kind of while that is like a nice, while that is, I guess, an admirable goal to have, if it comes at the cost of like everyone else around you, it's probably not that much of a legacy, is it? So yeah, I think it was sort of reflecting on like stuff like that, and, you know, the ends not justifying the means, and everything that kind of helped, and also like therapy. Like, I think shortly after I started, after shipping it, I started going to therapy and like talking through it with someone. That helped a lot, like a lot. I think without that, I'd still probably be struggling to reconcile a lot of stuff around that.
Jesus, yeah, therapy is good, man. There's a lot of people, yeah, though. Let me ask you this. When did you decide to take that first step? Did somebody ask or request of you, or did you just come to it and say, I got to do this myself, I got to go?
Someone said that I should go.
Yeah. Was it a fight? Did you resist? Or, if you don't mind, I know it's personal.
I'm trying to think. I don't think I did resist that much. Like, I think I knew, like I was like, yeah, I need to like unload all the stuff. And I did, I think the thing I did push back on for a little bit was, like medication for depression. Because like the concept in my mind was like, oh, it's going to change who I am and everything. And, you know, it didn't, obviously. And I don't think I have, you know, the kind of depression that is, you know, like the long-term kind that a lot of people that actually have depression have. Like, I think it was, you know, almost like a postnatal style depression where like you'd finish something super big and like you were just like destroyed inside. So, you know, like I was able to wean myself back off it as I felt like, you know, slowly. But yeah, I mean, that was only just out of like convenience because I was on such low dose anyway. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But yeah, I think, yeah, therapy and like actually medically looking into like why you may be feeling that way is super important too. And, you know, exercise is always big too. Just like having a balanced life really is a large part of that.
Man, I hear that. I gotta say, excuse me, I'm happier for you now. You know, I'm glad that you got through it and glad that you took the positive steps to change and develop a fulfilling life, you know, as your friend from EA said. And I'm happy to hear that, you know, the darkness didn't overcome.
So. Thank you. Yeah, it was, yeah, it's definitely a lot better now.
On a lighter side, though, me and my coworkers, so back at, I guess I don't care anymore, at 2K, it got really bad, right? With, you know, just triple A type of bad management, all that stuff, where we would be like internally kind of us talking to each other about, you know, getting out of this. And we always reference the last scene with the Shawshank Redemption.
Yeah, yeah.
Like as a meme, I would send it out like after a meeting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Just crawling through the sewers of crap and then coming out the free man. So well, even though you have some sewage dripping off of you,
yeah, man, yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think we can all say you're a better off man with it.
I think in equally funny meme style things, when I left and just for the record, like everyone who still works at EA, I love them and they're all great. Mm-hmm. When I left EA, I made you know the movie Escape from LA?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I just photoshopped that with my face and made it escape.
Send it to all the producers.
Yeah, I'm just like, send it around. I'm like, I'm out. See ya.
Let me just send this to Pound Company email list.
I think it was one of those things where like everyone knew I was ready to go, and like it was just like lighthearted. So like I was able to get to like kind of pass it off that way. And hide the anger and resentment boiling inside.
If any of them listen to the podcast, well, I have to say this, Josh, you have successfully podcast with us for an hour. Not many people make it this far, but you did.
Oh,
so yes, lovely. Yes, it's impressive. And as a reward for being so kind to give us these knowledge bombs and to hang out with us for this evening, Brandon and I are going to be quiet, and we're going to allow you to talk directly to our audience, to promote, to you know, talk about, to motivate, whatever it is that you want to do or draw attention and raise awareness for. The floor is now yours.
Cool. All right. Yeah, I'd probably say if there was things to take away, it would be to remember that everything you do does kind of come at some cost, like nothing's for free. And if you are like experiencing, you know, that kind of addictive cycle or just any other sort of mental illnesses or, you know, negative thought patterns, would definitely be to seek help with a therapist. I'm actually part of a little charity now called Checkpoint. So checkpoint.org. So if you go to Twitter, I think it's at checkpoint.org. Or you can also go www.checkpoint.org.au. Let me just double check that actually, because if that's wrong, that'll be really bad. yes, that's right. Then, you know, there's a lot of resources there for things that can help with mental illness and mental health, you know, games that you can play and stuff like that. And also just anecdotal stories from other developers and other gamers. Yeah, I think that's about it. The other one I'll obviously plug is Sequel to Frames coming out this year. So keep an eye out for that. You can follow us on Twitter at Love Shackers, and I think that's about it.
Wonderful, man. Thank you so much for hanging out with us and podcasting, and I really appreciate all the advice when it comes to depression, when it comes to overwhelming work situations, and I just appreciate you spending time with us, man. I'm not even going to be funny now. This is a very good discussion, so thank you. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much for having me, and yeah, it's good to chat with people about stuff like that, because a lot of the time people either ignore it or because it's too heavy or you know, they don't want to think about it at that point in time. So yeah, it's good to chat about.
And wait, it's really quiet, so I should probably say something, and it should probably go like, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for listening. I'm Larry Charles. Good night.
Thank you for joining us this week. See you guys next week. Later.
Cool. See ya.
If you enjoyed this podcast and you want to stay in touch or continue to follow our developments, then you need to go to facebook.com/gamedevunchained and drop a like and stay in touch. You can also get the direct feed for this podcast on soundcloud.com/gamedevunchained. So if you made it this far, then it probably means that you like what we do. So we're asking you to please take a moment to review us on iTunes. This way, future listeners can also find us and enjoy our weekly podcast. Thanks in advance, and have a wonderful Christmas holiday.